This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. A strange event took place at a meeting of the Hamilton County Commission on Wednesday morning, just as the anti-tax group that circulated petitions to force a proposed, well, and actually an adopted sales tax increase to go to the ballot in November. They were ready to announce that they had succeeded, that the commission, they had succeeded in raising the right number of signatures. The commission then took the wind out of their sails. The two Democratic members of the commission, Todd Portune and Denise Driehaus, reversed their positions and joined with Chris Monzell to repeal the 0.2% sales tax that was scheduled to go into effect in October. That leaves the commission with a gaping $28 million budget hole, and observers are questioning whether there was more than a tax policy question that was really involved here. To make sense of this move and where the county finds the money, we are joined by WVXU County Courthouse reporter Bill Reinhart, Cincinnati Enquirer politics reporter Scott Wortman, and WVXU politics reporter and columnist Howard Wilkinson. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Welcome, everybody,
thanks
back to Cincinnati
Hello.
Edition.
Great.
And first off, this is a pretty odd situation, and, you know, Howard, you've been around a long time. Scott, you've been around. Bill, we've all been around politics for a while.
Yep.
Ever seen anything like this, Howard?
No, I've never seen anything remotely like this. You know, it was amazing to begin with that two Democratic county commissioners would vote to increase the sales tax. Now, that was bad enough. Then when the Republicans see that, they jump on that and say, okay, we can run a petition campaign and get enough signatures to put this thing on a ballot. And I don't care what they say. They can say whatever they like about it. But the object was to get something on the ballot that would help drive out conservative Republican voters to help their candidates in November. Nothing wrong with that. That's part of the game. But they didn't want to put it out there that way. They wanted to talk about, you know, you need a choice. You should have a choice on whether or not we raise taxes. And it was all, you know, it was all nonsense.
So, Scott, did the commission originally have the right to raise this tax?
Yes. I mean, they can legally raise a sales tax, but normally when a government body and the commission raises a tax, it goes on the ballot, but they can unilaterally do it. But it was shocking when they did this in June. They didn't put it on the agenda. It kind of came up at a work group meeting, and it was just very sudden. Like, you know, we need this extra revenue. Otherwise, we're going to face this massive budget hole. And if we don't get this, it's going to be a serious financial problem for the county. And so it was very sudden when they put it on. And so this whole thing's been surprising.
Bill, on Wednesday, when all of this was happening, on the one hand, the petition drive proponents were announcing that they had enough petitions and they were sure they were going to get on the ballot. And then all of a sudden, what was the mood? What was going on around here?
Well, at County Commission, at the offices there, things were a little tense, and people were sitting in the meeting room waiting to see what would happen. They took an executive session, and they were out for what, about an hour?
Mm-hmm.
About an hour. Yeah. And the longer it went, the more you thought, yeah, they're going to have to yank this. And Todd Portune had said, no, we're not going to take this off because of political reasons. We did not put it on for political reasons. We're not going to take it off for political reasons.
So they took it off for political reasons.
Well, that's what you think, Howard.
Yes, it is.
And so let's we'll talk to about the political reasons here in a second.
Okay.
But what are the options that the commissioners now have in front of them for
finding $28 million to cut. Where are they going to look?
I mean, most of the budget is already obligated either to debt or state-mandated services. So there really aren't too many options to cut. Maybe some of the contract services, the townships like the sheriff's patrols, things like that.
Won't it kind of roll downhill? I mean, it'll roll down to some of the local communities. They'll have to start taking
911 fees, maybe.
911 fees and that kind of thing.
So the townships might have to pay a lot more.
Right.
Chris Munzel suggested they try to recoup some of these delinquent taxes. He says there's probably about $40 million the county is owed in delinquent tax. Well, there's $40 million that is owed in Hamilton County as delinquent taxes. And he says, you know, let's look at getting that back. And I apologize, I can't seem to find the tweet, but I'm pretty sure I saw one from Dusty Rhodes yesterday saying, yeah, you could do that, but most of that money is not owed to the county. That's not really going to help you.
And every government agency that I've covered, there's always delinquent taxes, and that's always usually like a fallback. Like we could collect more, but there's a reason why it's delinquent, either some legal reason or they will have to hire more manpower, which ends up costing more in the long run.
To chase people.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, are these, this is cumulative over some period of time of $40 million that is delinquent. And therefore, some of these are pretty complex stories.
Yeah, different taxpayers owing to different jurisdictions. It's not just Hamilton County. A lot of it apparently goes to schools.
A lot of it would go to the schools. I mean, look at your tax. When you get your tax bill and you look at where the money goes, a lot of that's going to go to the schools. So it wouldn't necessarily plug this. I mean, Sheriff's Department seems to be on the front line. I mean, there's a lot of personnel there, and costs are tied up in personnel, and that's going to be, I think, a real pressure point. You mentioned 911 as well. Now, it's interesting that 911 might be raised, and it has been raised in the early part of the discussion about the budget, at the very time that the city of Cincinnati is scrambling to improve its 911 service and model it after the county. So, but what about the sheriff? I mean, local communities would have to cough up more. So cities and probably mostly townships, is that where that's going
to
fall?
They'd have to revisit a lot of the contracts they have with these communities for extra sheriff patrols.
Yeah. If they have contracts, can they change the contracts on a short basis? Do they have time frames on those contracts?
That's above my pay grade.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they're staggered or not, but it probably wouldn't. Well, they can cut personnel. I mean, the sheriff did tell me that they, and I don't remember the specific number, but they lose several deputies a month through attrition. And he said that if this tax doesn't go through, they'll just leave these positions unfilled. And by the end of the year, that could equal, they'll be down like maybe 100 or so employees,
I think. That's a lot of people.
Yeah. It's a high turnover, and a lot of they retire like around, was it 50, the retirement age, or 55? Yeah. Yeah. So they can get rid of a lot of payroll, and that would be a lot of patrols to these townships.
Howard, one of the things I don't think people fully understand is that the county commissioners don't have control on the budgets of all of these independently elected officials.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that includes judges.
Right.
So the ability of the commissioners to go in and micromanage any particular department is really limited.
Yes, it's very limited. And, you know, I mean, basically they can set parameters, but they can't really tell these elected officials who run their own operations, you know, what they're going to do. To me, this whole thing goes back to when the legislature in Columbus, the Republicans, and John Kasich said, we are going to get rid of the local government fund. We are going to do away with the estate taxes. That was a tremendous blow to not only county governments, city governments, township governments. And they had to start scrambling to find ways to make up that money. They had depended upon it for years. And suddenly Kasich and the Republicans in Columbus took it away from them. And that is where all this started. And that's why you end up with things like two Democrats on the Hamilton County Commission passing a sales tax hike on their own.
You know, here's the situation. People forget that. It's been said a million times, but it's happened long enough ago that people have discounted it. The average person has discounted it. This has become the new normal. And, you know, was a fundamental mistake made here by the commission not to go through a ballot issue, because they could have at least made those kinds of arguments to the public and tried to explain to them why 0.2% sales tax would have been worth it. But they gave that up.
I can't say if that's a mistake or not. I mean, that's a value judgment I'm not prepared to make. But a lot of and this is more Howard's area of expertise. But a lot of people are looking at this November election and saying we're going to have a blue wave. The Democrats are angry. They're fired up. They're ready to go. They're going to hit the polls in large numbers. And this November would be a good time to put a sales tax issue on the ballot. We saw that with SORTA just last week. A lot of people said, well, why didn't you go ahead and do it? Because you're never going to have this kind of opportunity again. Whether or not that's true remains to be seen. But they could perhaps, if the Democrats do get out, this might be a good time to put something on the ballot.
I don't know if we want to get into the politics yet of it. I don't want to jump the gun here.
No, let's go ahead. Jump the gun.
But that would have also been problematic because this isn't just about the sales tax. This is a lot bigger than the sales tax. It has national importance with the congressional race on the west side of Cincinnati.
Steve Shabbat versus Aftab Perval.
And the Democrats did not want another tax issue on the ballot that could drive out conservative voters, because Aftab Perval, the Democratic candidate, already has an uphill battle with the large amount of Republicans in that district. And if it even boosted Republican turnout by 2-3%, that could have put it out of reach for him.
So besides the petition campaign going on out there in the community, there was this sudden appearance of this somewhat still mysterious threat of a lawsuit,
right?
And coming from the Katz Teller law firm,
yes.
And there's all kinds of twists there.
Yeah, there are all kinds of twists there, and there's in the Democratic Party in this county was badly split over this. There was. Even some of the leadership of the party was telling Portune and telling Driehaus, get rid of this. This is bad. This is going to end up hurting us. Others were saying, no, this is good. You know, we can have this discussion that you were talking about, you know, about why this is necessary. And Scott, you reported the Aftab Perival connection, you know, with Katz Teller. And people started looking at that and saying, maybe there was something going on here.
Well, as I understand it, the treasurer for that campaign, for Aftab's campaign, is a partner at Katz. Yeah.
And they're one of the law firm is one of the largest donors to individual donors to Aftab's campaign as well. I was pretty shocked, actually, how there was a pretty clear breadcrumb trail to Aftab, but it just took a simple Google search to tie it to him, right. Which I don't know if that was intentional or not, because, I mean, he can take credit maybe for sinking the sales tax. I don't know if that's—
I don't think that's what he's going to do, because
well,
that's got all kinds of implications.
He could, I suppose, and that might not be all bad.
Well, he came out against the sales tax.
Right,
yeah, he came out against the sales tax, but, you know, and I don't know what your experience was when you talked with his campaign manager about this, but when I did, it was immediately no comment. We are not going to comment we are not going to comment on this. Period.
But they did. They didn't try and argue with the story, which actually oftentimes I'll get if it's a story they don't want out.
Right.
See, if you weren't involved in this way, and you were asked that question, the normal response would be, no, we had nothing to do with it.
Even if you did.
Right. Even if you did. But that was not the response. Their response was no comment. So, you know, you can figure that one out for yourself.
And they couldn't have found another law firm to write the letter to that wasn't so clearly connected with them. It just seems...
Well,
and being mysterious about prior to that, about not prior to your story, about not telling who had asked them to write this letter.
The decision to rescind the sales tax, adopted 5 weeks ago by the county, has left lots of questions. And those are on top of the unresolved issues about the future of the proposed music venue at the banks. The developer is set, but where will it go? What is the design? And when can work begin? Business owners are getting very impatient at the lack of answers to those questions, possibly endangering the project itself, not to mention their own business viability. To discuss these issues, we are joined by Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Scott Wortman, WVXU County Courthouse reporter Bill Reinhardt, and WVXU political reporter and columnist Howard Wilkinson. To join our conversation, please call us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Bill, just to sort of look at this this whole kerfuffle around the sales tax. One thing that struck me was Matt Wallert, I think. Is that how he pronounces his name?
Wallert.
You know, from North College Hill, as a city council member, he almost seemed disappointed that he won because they rescinded the tax. But he was there was like, wait a minute, the people didn't get to vote.
Yeah, he spoke at the press conference Wednesday at the Board of Elections. Howard was there for that. And then he came over to the county commission. And when they pulled the tax back, he basically stood up and said, hey, you can't do this. We wanted a vote, which, you know, lends a little credence to the fact, to the idea that
they had already won.
Yeah, but it adds a little credence to the idea that they wanted the tax because it would drive out Republicans to the polls.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, there is financial and there are political implications of this whole thing. Speaking of another issue that's complex, Scott, you wrote an article this week about the Banks Music Venue and sort of people getting nervous about where we stand on this. You know, 2 months ago, the proposed music venue was front and center. Everybody was paying attention. We did a whole bunch of segments on Cincinnati Edition. Where does it stand right now at this moment?
Well, no one's really saying. County commissioners, the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra, which is the developer picked to build the music venue, they're saying, oh, it's still forefront. Like the head of the CSO's music division, booking division, said, we're selling it on the coast to music promoters, but when's it going to be built? And they don't even know where they're going to build it on the banks. And there's no timetable at this point, which I find remarkable because there was such a sense of urgency in May and June when they were debating who's going to build it, like the riverfront depended on building this music venue, and everyone said time is of the essence. We're going to have to decide this in the next month or two. Where, you know, how we're going to build it, what's exactly is going to be built, and now it's just kind of like it's on a back burner.
You quoted John Cranley, the mayor of the city of Cincinnati, who has an interest in this as well as the county, which is a point here. He's saying we're far from a deal.
Yeah,
yeah, we're not close. First off, he wanted a different developer. He wanted Promo West. But, you know, city and the county seemingly haven't moved any closer on this and sort of hammering out the details.
Well, the issue, and talking to the bank's business owners, particularly the ones that have been there long term, like the owner of the Holy Grail, no one's really controlled the banks, no one person. There are a lot of cooks in the kitchen, so to speak. Making these decisions.
Gee, so is this a familiar story? All right, go ahead.
It requires a lot of people to get on board, and it takes a long time to get, you know, anything going. And as the former mayor Charlie Lucan, who sits on the Joint Bank Steering Committee, which advises, you know, what should go on the banks, said the Bengals, because of the lease, they're the elephant in the room for development on the riverfront, and they're not budging on wanting a specific lot that's a large piece of will take up a lot more piece of property than what everyone else wants.
The initial goal was to put it on what's called Lot 27.
Yes.
Which is close to the stadium, the Paul Brown mm-hmm. Stadium. And it's
prime tailgating territory.
Oh, yes. And it's prime tailgating territory, but
which is important to them.
Yeah. And that's what Mike Brown says. He's just standing mm-hmm. up for the rights of Bengals fans.
Well, if you look at any of the original Banks plans, that's going to be built on no matter what. If they put a music venue there or not, it's going to be built on. You won't be able to tailgate there. So I really don't know that argument carries a lot of water.
Having to – when I was doing this story, because there's a lot of history involved that I had to get caught up to speed on, it was evidently a mess in the 90s planning these stadiums. I wasn't covering it at the time. But this all goes back to deciding where to put the Great American Ballpark and Paul Brown Stadium. And Mike Brown wanted the location of Paul Brown Stadium to be by the suspension bridge where the Red Stadium is. But the Reds got that location. And so when the commissioners at the time were hammering out a deal with the Bengals, they're like, look, we'll put you further west down here on old Castellini Produce's warehouses. But they gave them, in addition to a bunch of other concessions, they gave them all these rights around there so their view wouldn't be blocked of the river. So the Bengals' view wouldn't be blocked of the river and the bridge. And so this all goes back to the compromise.
Anything that's above two stories, yeah. The Bengals have the right to weigh in on, maybe even veto. And, okay, gee, something was built that was 12 stories, the GE. And the Bengals got something back for that $16.5 million.
New scoreboard.
Yeah. New scoreboard, yeah. Refurbished right. Locker rooms. Is that what we're talking about here? Just figuring out what the Bengals want in exchange for letting the music venue go to Lot 27?
Mike Brown likes to win. Maybe not doesn't do it much with football games, but he does like to win these kind of battles, and I wouldn't bet against him.
Oh, yeah.
If he's, you know, trying to negotiate for something down there, it's got to be more than just space for the tailgaters. Tailgaters can go somewhere else. Tailgaters can, you know, move around.
Bengals officials have told me, though, that that is the single largest lot, like the any of the last four tailgating. So it is pretty – I don't think they're making it up when they said, though, it is pretty valuable to them as a team to have that.
They want to move it to Lot 24. Yeah. You know, and if you don't know the map and you're not familiar with this – this may not sound very important, but Lot 24 is slotted for some real serious development, right, Bill?
They've got townhouses. They've got micro apartments?
Micro apartments.
Retail, business, the whole thing.
And that's Jeffrey Anderson Development, that is a local developer who wants to do that. And the one thing that is clear that does work down there is housing.
Yeah.
The rental properties down there have gone very, very well.
And it is the value of the land down there, too, that even if that Jeffrey R. Anderson proposed development doesn't go forward the 2.2-acre lot that's proposed for is worth a lot of money. It's worth like $10 million, whereas where the CSO wants to build on Lot 27, it's 3/4 of an acre. It's about a third of that cost in land cost, which is what makes that much more desirable for the officials.
So, Scott, who has to make a move here? In whose court is the ball, and somebody has to make a move to make something happen?
Well, it's that's, again, why it hasn't moved forward, because it's in everybody's court. It's in the city's court, the county's court, and the Bengals. And if the Bengals don't relent on their lease, there really is not much that the city or county can do, because the lease is ironclad. They unless they're willing to pay whatever legal fees, because they will go to court if they violate the lease. So it would be way too expensive that, you know. So if the Bengals don't relent and they don't want it on Lot 24, then there's really nothing to do.
Could the whole thing just collapse?
It could be held up indefinitely if they don't compromise. Yeah.
So the implications are not just for the music site, it's for the businesses that are already there.
Yeah.
So the restaurants and the various outlets that are depending
nearby,
on
– nearby, too. There was a bar – that's not technically in the banks. They tweeted at me last night saying, what's going on? Let's get this going. We will rely on this as well.
I've heard from them, too, that with like concerts – because I've heard some skepticism, like, is this really going to drive a lot of traffic? But a lot of the business owners say that the concerts at the Coliseum are usually their best – or the U.S. Bank Arena are the best driver of traffic, far more than the sporting events, because everyone stays in the stadium and they don't really go to the venues.
Right. Well, there's only so many football games. And baseball this year has struggled with attendance, and so it's not quite as strong as normally hoped for and whatever. So all of those things come in and are factors. So and the goal was to have this open by the summer of 19, right?
Closer to the fall, late 2019.
But it doesn't look like they're going to hit that because they had said in May or June that they'd have to have the development agreement already hammered out by
now. So we're even later than – there's no way of catching back up.
But do you remember when they first broke ground on the banks in 2008, it was still a year before anything actually happened. Right. I remember walking past every day, seeing the big pile of dirt they used for the official groundbreaking, and it just sat there and sat there and sat there.
It was a very nice pile of dirt.
It was.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Scott, Bill, and Howard for being here today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. This week, Cincinnati City Council adopted five proposed charter amendments, four of which will appear for sure. One is still up in the air. Two others may come forward later. Council also faced a judicial ruling staying the collection of fees it imposed on billboards as a way of balancing its budget. To clarify these developments, we are joined now by WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. Jay, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Okay. So first off, these proposals that for charter reforms. Is this come out of the same process that was started when Kevin Flynn was on council and there was a review of the charter? Are these sort of responding to whatever need is out there?
You know, that's a hard question to answer. I think some of the things were considered by Mr. Flynn's charter committee, but they didn't have the support to make the ballot. And I think after the last council election, there's been some talk about, geez, if we only elect these guys every 4 years, is that really what we want? So that's why there's some talk about changing the terms. And then one that Councilmember Flynn proposed and almost got approved last time was for the executive or closed sessions, and that may or may not be on the ballot, but we'll get into that.
Okay, let's get into some of these. Probably the ones that are going to draw the most attention are the ones about the length of term. And right now, traditionally from 1925 until 5 years ago, we had 2-year terms. Now we've got 4-year terms, and people are raising questions about this. There are actually two different amendments here. What are the two amendments that are being proposed?
The two that are proposed are to go back to the 2-year terms. So if it were approved starting in 2021, all the council members elected that year would serve for 2 years, be on the ballot again in 2023. The other one would create staggered 4-year terms. And in 2021, the way this one is set up, the top five vote-getters in that 2021 election would get to serve for 4 years. So they would be elected in 2021, wouldn't have to run again until 2025. Positions 6, 7, 8, and 9 would serve for 2 years. They would run again in 2023, and if they were reelected in 23, they would start on the 4-year terms, and then you wouldn't have
It's a way of getting the staggered terms
correct,
going.
To set up. So there would be, if it worked in 2023, you would elect 4 council members. 2025, you would elect 5 and go that way, you know, and for 5 and 4 and until they decide to change it again.
Right. So first off, what's the problem with the current system that obviously both of these are trying to address?
I think you're getting the sense that folks want to see their council members, and they seem to insist that the only time they see their council members out at civic events or in the neighborhoods is when they're asking for their votes. And if they're doing that every 2 years, there's more likelihood that they'll see their council members, or even staggered, they would have the same chance.
Well, the other side of that is when the 4-year terms were adopted, the argument was council members spend all of their time
campaigning,
campaign, either raising money, getting ready to campaign, or actively campaigning. So, you know, the first 8 months of the first year that they're elected, they've got, and then everything else was about campaigning. And they said if we had 4-year terms, we would really be able to concentrate and do the city's work.
And I think a lot of this thing, and Dan, you've been in the city a long time. We're never happy with the system that we have to elect council members, and it's always up for debate. How many times have we heard about proportional representation? Should we divide the city up into districts, 2-year terms, 4-year terms? And, you know, my guess is we'll either go one of two ways here, and other if not, we'll let that go for 10 or 15 years and we'll be back to change it again.
Well, a couple of things here. We could go both ways. People, both of these are running independently, and people could vote for both of them. They could both pass. What happens then?
There is a tiebreaker.
there is a tiebreaker. Okay.
You're right. You could conceivably vote for 2-year terms and 4-year terms. And if that happens, the one with the highest winning percentage will take effect. So, for example, if 2-year terms gets 30,000 votes and 4-year terms gets 40,000 votes, it'll be the 4-year staggered terms. And remember, voters could reject both measures, and then we'll have what we have now, all 9 members being elected to a 4-year term.
And we'll just continue that.
We'll continue on that pattern.
By the way, on the 4-year staggered terms, Amy Murray and Jeff Pastor voted against that. And I thought that Amy had some interesting points there. What was her argument on that one?
I think, and I've heard this from other Republicans too, that they're fearful that if you do this, basically it's going to be a totally Democratic council because you'll have 5 Democrats picked and selected, you know, for the first go around, and when you do the 4,
which they'll finish high,
right, and then they'll do a sample ballot for 4 Democrats in 2023, and there's a high likelihood that those 4 Democrats could get elected. Basically, the fear is that the Republicans, Charterites, and independents could be locked out of council seats.
One of the other proposals was that prohibiting unlimited and anonymous contributions through limited liability corporations, LLCs. And this was something that the mayor got a lot of money from last time and became sort of an issue. What's the argument here? This proposal would ban that. Is that correct?
Right. And so that means that if I have J LLC and I want to make a contribution to a candidate, I'm going to have the same cap that if I were donating myself as an individual, which is $1,100. And if an LLC has multiple members, you have to assign your donation to a person in that LLC. So you can't – the goal is to hold the campaign limit of $1,100 just like an individual onto an LLC and its members. So you couldn't – you know, I think conceivably if you had 5 members, each person could give up to $1,100, but they're all going to be capped at that $1,100.
And they're going to be revealed.
Right.
And they're going to be revealed. Right. So it's a sunshine sort of law.
Right.
And the one person who was opposed to this was Jeff Pastor, which raises an interesting question here.
Yeah, that's true because his campaign was...
We've still not settled that.
We've not settled that, and it was largely financed by, I think it's his boss, and yeah, he was the only vote against it.
There is another proposal that did make it through, and that's a civil service change. Is there anybody really opposing that?
I don't think so. There were some questions about it. I know there were some council members who – I think there were 3 council members who voted against it. But basically – and I'm not going to be claim to be an expert on this, but basically the city gives a civil service exam. And right now, if you're a military veteran from Ohio, you get 5 extra points. Basically, they want to eliminate that Ohio residency requirement. This would primarily affect the police department. If a member of the military lives in Alabama and wants to relocate to Cincinnati, they would get that same bonus points just like an Ohio resident. But they have to change it so it says take out the Ohio resident part.
The proposed charter amendment that was vetoed by the mayor was an amendment about open meetings. And so the amendment would allow council to go into executive session secret session to take care of certain things like personnel issues, the firing of a city manager, for example.
And that's probably why it's got a little bit more attention this year.
Right. And certain other pending litigation when the city's being sued. That is not unusual. It is actually allowed under Ohio law to for local bodies to do that. Why did the mayor reject this?
Well, it was interesting, and he rejected it hard because he vetoed it, and he actually called it the secret government amendment. And he talks about transparency and that, you know, the council proceedings should be in the open no matter what they are. And so he is absolutely opposed to executive session. Councilmember David Mann is the one who proposed this, and largely for the reasons that you talked about, that during the whole debacle with Harry Black, and even, you know, I know there are some members of the media who may cringe when I say this, but because we're all about open government.
Right.
But I think there are just some things that, you know, if you're an employee, you probably don't want your dirty laundry aired in public. And unfortunately, that's what happened in the city manager case, because they couldn't have an executive session or a closed session to review his performance or talk about the issues.
You know, and all you have to do if you want to find out why this is such a controversy in the city of Cincinnati and not a controversy, say, over in Northern Kentucky, laws are different. I mean, this is not totally unusual, this proposal.
And as you said, I think I don't want to go out and say that Cincinnati is the only city that doesn't have executive session, but it was a lawsuit filed several years ago by the Enquirer that said, hey, you're charter doesn't say that you can do this. A court agreed. And from that point forward, there haven't been executive or closed sessions for Cincinnati City Council.
One last area over at City Hall, and that is the ruling by a judge, a common pleas judge, that the billboard taxes, actually there are multiple fees that are applied to the big billboard companies and passed on to their customers, would have to be paid. And this was purely to raise money for the general fund.
Correct.
And to, as I understand it, I don't think it was tagged to a particular issue, but it seems like...
Oh, wait, no, it was tagged.
So the money from that is to go...
Part of it was to go to human services. I think part of it was to go to Center for Closing the Health Gap, and then some economic development programs like Centrifuge, I think, was one that I can think of off the top of my head.
Okay, so this is $700,000 that now is a big hole. It's a $700,000 hole in the budget. What are they going to do?
They are discussing that right now. The judge issued a temporary restraining order. He's going to hold a hearing in September on whether that should be permanent. Based on the written opinion that I've read for the TRO, I can't see any reason to believe that he won't make it permanent. So Mayor Cranley has introduced a proposal to trim some funding. He's suggesting, again, eliminating funding from the Center for Closing the Health Gap to help fix that hole, and then it'll be up to council to either go with that or come up with $700,000 in either some new revenue or a series of cuts to make up the difference.
The argument here is that from the companies is that this is a restraint of First Amendment.
I saw First Amendment mentioned, and they also mentioned the equal protection, the 14th Amendment.
Right. So there's going to be issues here around – these are constitutional issues that are being appealed.
And even if, you know, if the injunction is made permanent, the city can appeal that. But that takes time, and by the time they probably have a ruling, this budget year is probably going to be over. So if this is permanent, that $700,000 is gone for this fiscal year.
They've got to do something.
They've got to do something.
Jay, thanks for being with us today.
No problem.
And finally, the world of local television just keeps turning. WXIX Channel 19 turns 50 and announces that it's adding two newscasts that will directly challenge the other three local stations. Plus, long-established reporters and anchors with huge followings are exiting some stations. To provide perspective on the ins and outs of local television, we are joined now by WVXU blogger John Kieswetter, who has followed the local and national developments in the television industry for 33 years. To join our conversation, please call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. John, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks.
And you're usually interviewing me about some crazy thing, so this is fun. The story about WXIX, quite the story in the modern period for a local station to emerge like this.
I really think so. I mean, we can think back, longtime listeners and viewers. When was the last time there was a new newscast at 11 o'clock? I mean, you can go back to Al Schottelkotty, Nick Clooney, Peter Grant, Jerry Springer. There was just three at 11. And Fox 19, which is doing well at 10 o'clock, is going to go from 10 to 11:35. So they're going to do their normal hour, and then they're going to do 35 minutes after it to go head-to-head with the big three or the other three.
Right. Well, and Local 12 a few years ago decided that it was going to introduce a 10 o'clock as well as an 11 o'clock because XIX was grabbing a lot of the market and people were going to bed earlier.
So there's one on Star 64 that Channel 12 does, and there's one on MeTV that Channel 5 does. So there, you got three choices at 10.
There you go.
But Fox 19 had said that in terms of the demos, the demographic, 18 to 49, 25, 54, that the advertisers want, that they've been number one in late night for the past couple of years. And so this was now the time to expand.
Okay. And people sometimes get confused about what you just said. You know, one thing is how many people are watching a newscast. The other thing about is who is watching a newscast, the demo. And you want that 18 to 54 or 25 to whatever. You know, the numbers can be sliced and diced in different ways. But, you know, as somebody who worked in a TV newsroom for a long time, you know, the first thing you do when you walk in the morning, everybody picks up the rate sheet from the night before. And, yeah, how many people are watching every 15 minutes?
It is not just how many people are watching, if the right people are watching.
Right people are watching.
Of that age group, particularly, it probably skews more female than male in their sales.
Okay. And Catherine Nero at WCPO had her contract. CPO didn't pick up her option for a third year. She's been with the station for a long time, almost 20 years. What's going on there, and what's your view on that?
My view on that was actually when I went back and looked in January when she had her 20th anniversary, they had a really nice piece on the website and said, for 20 years, she's been a class act, and thank you, here's to 20 years more. But 2 months later, in March, her co-anchor, Chris Riva, was let go, which kind of surprised me and I think a lot of people. And I think from that point on that they were making a decision, you know, do we just change the whole team? She was 2 years in and they had an option on the third year and surprised her, called her in and said, sorry, you know, this is it. And the response to that has been overwhelming. I mean, when I saw her post something quickly on Facebook Tuesday and in the first hour she had 400 comments. So I'm just guessing that, again, Fox 19 tells me they've been number one in the demo in the morning, 6 to 7, that we had an old friend, Daryl Parks, used to run WLW, who said, the answer to most questions is ratings and revenue. And I'm going to guess that they saw rating trends here that they figured because they've retooled that show. You know, Larry Hanley was left 3 or 4 years ago. They've changed the traffic person. That they must thought, okay, we just got to blow it up and start all over again to rebuild the audience.
One of the comments I saw was that, you know, the explanation coming out of CPO was that they were going to go in a new direction, but they couldn't tell you what the direction was.
Exactly.
But, you know, that's not totally surprising.
My question to them was, how soon do we see a new team? Because it usually means after the November, either you're going to do it in September for the fall season, or you can't do it till after November because the people you want are contractually obligated somewhere else. And they couldn't answer the question. You know, so they're holding their cards very close to the vest.
Let's move over to Local 12, which obviously I've got a huge conflict of interest there. I was there for 36 years. There's been a lot of change there.
Exactly. Since you left in end of September, 7 people have left the newsroom. Most recently was Brandon Orr, who's one of their 4 meteorologists, announced just this week that next Thursday is his last day. He's going to a TV station in Miami. Before that, it was Larry Davis, who had some heart issues, had a stent put in. And he decided to retire a year earlier than he was planning to. But he said, look, I just didn't need the pressure.
In May, Deb Dixon left after 44 years. In February, Brad Johansson left after 26 years.
For an opportunity.
Yeah. I looked at them, and of the seven people left, three retired. You, Larry, and Deborah Dixon. Three took other opportunities. That would be Sidney Bender, who was only there a couple of years, and Brandon Orr, and Brad Johansson. He's going to be a main anchor. And the seventh person was Scott Demick, who left Channel 12 as a meteorologist and has switched to businesses. So, you know, when this company, Sinclair Broadcast Group, brought the station in late 2012, I thought, uh-oh, they were kind of known for penny pinching, and we're going to see a lot of this veteran talent, news talent on the air. They're going to be leaving for retirement or lesser contracts or whatever. And it didn't happen, but now it's starting to happen.
Yeah, I want to make it clear that I left. They still call me in for election night, so I still have a relationship there. And I'm different. I was there as a contractor. I was never an employee. I was always a contractor for 36 years. And when I was first hired in 1981, Don North was interviewing me. 10 minutes into the interview, he said, "Are you ready to be fired?" I said, "What do you mean, Don? I didn't know you hired me." And his thing was, "Well, I'm worried about you. Come from not-for-profits and academia, and people don't get fired there." It's not exactly true, but he said, "In this business, everybody's going to get fired. The only question is when you get fired." So, a person like Deb Dixon is really the unusual person who has just this magnificent career and retires at the end of it,
and basically leave on her own terms. Mm-hmm. Although she did make it clear to me that if they would have, quote, "if the company had wanted me to stay, they wouldn't give me the offer that was so easy to refuse." It's interesting. There's a couple other reporters just to keep my eye on the staff at 12, but I really think we're seeing a changing of the guard there.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that. You know, one of the things, too, that people, I think, maybe need to recognize is how much the business has changed. Local stations, all they've got now is news. In the old format, there were variety shows. There were all kinds of things that you could produce locally and you could make money with. Not anymore. So news just keeps expanding because that's where you can sell the product.
And that's your own – that's your totally your own commercial inventory to sell. So at Channel 19 from 4:30 to 11 in the morning, that's all theirs. And that was really one of the reasons that Nine gave up Wheel and Jeopardy a few years back. They've tried some other shows there in that hour, but they're locally owned by Scripps, so they would control the advertising revenue. You know, during the network and during Dr. Phil or the syndicated shows, they just get a couple of commercial slots. The rest are controlled by the owners of the show.
And you've been following this for a long time. With all the change with other services and the way people get entertainment, this is just going to continue to change.
Sooner or later, with the way people stream shows and watch shows, you know, they're going to look at that big electric bill they've got for the tower and wonder, why are we doing this?
Thank you very much for being here today.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The segment producer is Layla Shakui. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.